my night, isn't it?
Some of you I haven't seen before, welcome. But why I mean my night is that on Thursday night we do classical Buddhist exploration of a book called the Majjhima Nikaya. Do you know what that means? Of course not. It's I'm so glad you don't know, because that makes me sound erudite for a short moment here, and I get very few of these moments with this group, so I appreciate that. The Majjhima Nikaya, they've all read so much. The Majjhima Nikaya is, Majjhima means middle length, and Nikaya is sayings. And in the Buddhist tradition there are, I think it's 50 odd books that make up what in Christianity would be the Bible. And one of the books is the Majjhima Nikaya, which is the middle-length sayings, which means the talks that the Buddha is purported to have given that aren't too long and aren't too short. Because there's also the Digha Nikaya, which is the long ones, and then there's the short ones, but this one is the middle-length. And there's 152 of those talks. So what I decided a few years ago now, was that it would be nice for people to have an overview of what the actual classical Buddhist meditation, Buddhist teaching was, for those who were interested. So on Thursday night, we're slowly picking our way through the Majjhima Nikaya. Does that give you an idea? Friday night, I get to talk about whatever I feel like talking about. Saturday night, you get to ask me whatever questions you want to ask. And Sunday we do a meditation on Chenrezig. Right? Is that what we do? Mm-hmm. Got it right? Mm-hmm. Just checking. So we always start by going Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo means I name, Tassa the state, Bhagavato of blessedness. Arahato has several meanings of purity, trustworthiness, victory. Sama, fully, Sambuddhassa, with the state of discovery. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa. So because you always want to start by naming your aspiration. So we've done that. There's a cushion up here, and there's a cushion back there. And if one goes to the FPMT website, FPMT Foundation for the Preservation of Mahayana Tradition website, it is possible to download or read teachings given by one of the two founders of that North American school tradition. One of the two founders, whose name is Lama Yeshe. Lama Yeshe was a very great teacher, a very compassionate man, and so surprising and rare for someone who was from a totally different culture, his ability to speak in a very practical way to Westerners or anyone whose language he spoke about the practice, the essential practices of meditation that do not involve what you believe or what you don't believe, but to be seen for oneself, I find to be staggering. I find his clarity and his directness to be so useful. Over and over again, I find myself going back to his teaching just to see where I'm getting dogmatic or I'm getting caught up in ritual language rather than examining things closely. Does that make sense to you? And it's free to download. It's very good. And while I was with my hosts, this morning on the table was this nice little article that one of my hosts had downloaded from FPMT's website of a talk that Lama Yeshe gave in Melbourne, Australia in the mid-70s. So this is a while ago. And in Australia, have any of you been to Australia? Some of you have been to, yeah. So Australia is very interesting, isn't it? I mean, in Australia they have sayings like, what is that, tall poppy syndrome. Do you know that one? You know that one. And, you know, it took me forever to figure that out. You know what the tall poppy, you know, tall poppy syndrome, do you know what it is?
Mm-hmm.
Basically, if you go into a place, like it could be a wedding, it could be a talk, it could be a funeral, it could be a party, it could be anything, and there's a whole row of seats, sort of that some seats are right in the front or something, and then the next seats are further back, the front seats are never taken up. Nobody sits in the front. Why? I wondered why. If you're asking a question, so you're in a, if you're giving a talk like this and you're dialoguing with people, you know how I always like people to talk back to me. You know that, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
In Australia, it's like trying to squeeze milk out of a stone, getting people to talk. The first person to talk, everybody sort of looks at them and goes, but after a while, if you really like, you know, really go at them and, you know, bug them and make them laugh and insult them and jolly them up just the right amount, suddenly they'll start talking. But to the first people to talk, it's like, hard work. Because the tall poppy syndrome is like the tallest poppies get cut down. And nobody wants to be the tall poppy. Because if you put your hand up first, it means that you're going to get cut down. If you take a front seat, it means that you're being a tall poppy. You're being like, you know, I'm up here and I'm going to tell you what you should really be talking about, kind of thing. Interesting, huh?
Mm-hmm.
And you know that Australia was basically began by two groups of people, the convicts and the guards. And there were almost the same amount. Did you know that?
Mm-hmm.
No. It's really interesting, isn't it? Prison colonies. Because the Aboriginals were not real people. You understand that? There was the prisoners, the guards, and then the cute animals that were good for chasing and killing, basically. That was basically the few. So you got this kind of sense of like everybody is supposed to know their place, and there's a kind of like there's rules for these ones and rules for these ones, and like one of the rules was you didn't want to step outside some invisible line because you didn't know whether it was line or not, so like the tall poppy syndrome. So here is Lama Yeshe in this culture in the 70s. And he is talking to people who don't have really a lot of sense of Buddhism. And I just think it is so beautiful the way he starts. He says the way we live and think everything is dedicated. The way we live and think everything is dedicated. The way we live and think is everything is dedicated to material pleasure. Do you think that's true in your life? If you woke up in the morning and there was no hot water, how would you feel? Yeah. And would you think that something, you had been insulted somehow, that you paid your hot water bill? And you know what I'm saying here?
Mm-hmm.
If you went out your front door and you found out that somebody had parked a big boulder in the middle of your sidewalk, would you feel personally insulted? If you got to work and your office was locked and there was no... Do you understand what I'm saying? There is this kind of a sense that you have the right to proceed with the pleasures and the patterns that... Don't we? Don't we have that sense? The way we live and think, everything is dedicated to material pleasure. Like the material world should please what we expect of it. We consider sense objects to be of utmost importance and materialistically devote ourselves to whatever makes us happy, famous, and popular. He's pretty well got that one. He could have added loved, but, you know, I mean, he's got three of the big four named there. Even though all this comes from our mind, we're so totally preoccupied by the external objects themselves that we never look within. If there is no hot water, you don't look in and watch who is it that's bothered, do you? Or something interferes with your day. Do you look within, or do you... We never question what makes them so interesting. However, this mind is an inseparable part of us. As long as we exist, our mind is there within us. Thus, we are always up and down. It's not our body that goes up and down, is it? It's your mind, isn't it? The mind whose way of functioning we do not understand. Isn't that true? You feel happy, you feel sad. And there's this feeling like it's an actual material thing, but really it's your mind. And very rarely does one ever say, I wonder why the same mind can be happy and then sad within a split second. Because it can, can't it? The smallest little thing changes. Flip. You've heard me say this 1,000 times. You totally fall in love. Everything is wonderful. You just love the way her cute little ear, you know, how she just folds that hair just behind that cute little ear, and it's just so sweet. And then, you know, you're living with her for like a couple of years, and then you notice every time you try to tell her something, she just does that little ear thing. And then one time you really want her to pay attention because there's something important, and she turns around and goes, and you think, every time I'm going to talk to you, you touch your fucking ear. Right? So one moment, it's like so charming. And the next moment, it's all the evidence you ever needed to just like see that the whole world is crap. Is that true? Do you do that? I do that. Have you done that? One or two of you? Some of you aren't going to answer. Regardless of what I say. Okay, that's fine. I don't mind. 12 poppies. Therefore, sometimes you have to examine yourself, not just your body, but your mind, which is the thing that is telling you what to do. You have to know your own psychology, or in religious terminology, perhaps, your inner nature. No matter what you call it, you have to know your own mind. Don't think that examining and knowing the nature of your mind is only an Eastern trip. That's a wrong conception. It's not an Eastern trip. It's your trip. You know, like, just let's get real here. How can you separate your body or the picture you have of yourself from your mind? That's interesting, isn't it? You can't say, I have the material power to separate my mind from my body. Because that's not true. It's impossible. You think you're a free person in the world, enjoying everything. That's what you think, but you're not free. I'm not saying that you're under the control of someone else. It's your own attachment, your own uncontrolled mind that oppresses you. If you can discover how it oppresses you, the uncontrolled mind will automatically disappear. Just that straightforward. Thus, knowing your own mind is the solution for your mental problems. One day the world is beautiful, the next day it's so bad. How can you say that? Scientifically, it's impossible for the world to change radically like that within 24 hours. It's simply your mind that makes this happen. Don't think this is religious dogma, or going up and down is not religious dogma. I'm not talking about religion. I'm talking about the way you lead your life, which is what sends you up and down. The people and the environment don't change radically. The changes are your own mind. Surely you can understand that. It's so simple. Similarly, one person thinks the world is beautiful and people are wonderful and kind, but another thinks that everyone and everything is horrible. Who's right? How do you explain that scientifically? It's just their individual mind's projection of the sense world. So you feel today is like this, tomorrow is like that, this man is like this, that woman is like that. But where is the absolutely fixed, forever beautiful woman? Who is the absolutely forever handsome man? They're non-existent. They're creations of your mind. Also, you should not expect material objects to satisfy you and make your life perfect. That too is impossible. How can you be satisfied by even vast amounts of material objects? How can you be satisfied by sleeping with hundreds of different people? It's impossible. Satisfaction comes from the mind. Your dissatisfied mind, wanting to keep changing from one person to another, from one trip to another, can never satisfy you. It's your mind. If you don't know your own psychology, you might ignore what's going on in your mind until it breaks down and you go completely crazy. It's pretty straightforward about that. I mean, those are the options. People go mad through lack of inner wisdom, through the lack of the ability to examine their own mind. They can't explain themselves to themselves. They don't know how to talk to themselves. Thus, they are constantly preoccupied with all these external objects while their mind within is running down until finally it cracks. They're ignorant of their internal world. Their minds are totally unified with ignorance instead of being awake and engaged in self-analysis. It is so necessary to examine your own mental attitudes. It is essential that you become your own therapist. You're intelligent. You know that material objects alone cannot bring you satisfaction. However, you don't need to embark on some emotional, religious trip to examine your mind. Some people think they do. They think this kind of self-analysis is something spiritual or religious. To do this, it is not necessary to classify yourself as a follower of this or that philosophy or religion. But if you want to be happy, you do have to check the way you lead your life. For this, you don't need to put yourself into some religious category. Your own mind is your religion. Isn't that beautiful?
Mm-hmm.
Your own mind is your religion. Mm-hmm. There. Period. If we are not equally interested in the fact that we believe something, as in what we believe, we are setting ourselves up for suffering. Do you understand what I'm saying here? That until I start looking at the fact that I want to believe something with as much interest as I look at what it is I want, I am setting myself up for suffering. So long as I think that some external object is going to give me pleasure, I am caught in servitude. Because somehow or other, I always have to be busy manipulating, politicking, making sure that I have this relationship with that object. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
Or that circumstance, or that hot water heater, or that car. Is that true? That there is this continuous kind of play. But when I realize, or when you look at the fact that like 10 years ago, it was a different object, was it? 10 years ago, can you remember 10 years ago? There was a different object then, wasn't there?
Mm-hmm.
And there was that same, but do you care about that object anymore? Probably not. Or sort of, you don't want to give it up, but you're not really using it. Using it as a comparison, but not with the same passion. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
Are you just saying mm-hmm? Or are you, do you think that's really true?
Yes,
I wonder.
It's really true.
Okay, you know I need my amens. So then what is it that's interesting here? Is it the object of devotion or is it the act of devotion that has the real power here? Which is it?
Yeah.
The act. So why isn't there at least as much interest in watching how the act toward devotion comes up or revulsion comes up. How come there isn't as much interest in that as there is interest in the outer object? How come? It's like some kind of superstitious feeling, isn't it? It's like, if I get that, everything will be all right. You know that if you believe something and you actually believe that it's going to make you happy, and then when it doesn't make you happy, that will result in what?
Suffering,
anger, mm-hmm. anger. Mm-hmm. You really think, I remember one time, I hate to do these, let me confess my sordid past, but of course I'm going to do another one. And it'll be on tape yet again. One time there was this man who decided that he and I were meant to be tantric lovers. And he was quite convinced of this, and it was impossible to dissuade him. So finally, out of desperation, I thought the only way for the guy to come to his senses is to live with me. If anybody lives with me for any period of time, we'll give up on that one, you know? I mean, it's just not viable. You know? So I moved in with him. So we're living together, and it becomes obvious to him that, you know, I'm not exactly... So what does he do? He starts figures maybe, well, if he beats on me a bit, I'll get, I'll mold into shape, right? And because interrupted desire creates aggression. Because you don't start looking at your devotion, you start saying there's something wrong with that. It should be different. That's how I learned how to do loving kindness, by the way. I noticed that whenever I actually really chanted, performed, meditated on loving kindness, something would happen. A neighbor would come in, or, he'd trip, or the cat would come and meow at and rub against his leg. It was very interesting. But that's a whole other class. For tonight, let's look at just this thing of when there is something that you're trying for and it's an outer object, to be equally interested in who is trying or what is it in the mind that creates desire and then projects it out. When you actually start to look at who it is that is wanting with as much interest, not blame, not good or bad, not judgment, just kindness and interest, just kindness and interest, just be interested. Who is here? Suddenly you find you're projecting less, you're going less up and down, you're finding less criticism and unhappiness. Suddenly you find you're actually really interested in, well, who is this? Who am I? What is consciousness? What is mind? You see, religion is your mind. What you have to believe is that you have the right to ask, who is here? What is this? How are we? There is nothing else that is more important. Until I know who it is that is wishing for this thing to happen, or hating that that thing happens, or being indifferent about the other thing happening, until I know who is doing that, how can I possibly trust what I'm seeing? Have you ever looked at something one time and seen it one way, and then later seen it a different way? One day something looked interesting, the next day it was boring. Is it the thing that changes? Is it? Isn't that interesting? And yet when I say to you, really the Buddha suggested over and over again that it's extremely useful when you find yourself disliking something, find something you like in it, just for the heaven of it, or the earth of it, or to escape the hell of it. And when you see something you like, find something you dislike in it. So that you're actually playing with your own mind, trying to understand how come like comes up here, how come dislike comes up here. So you can actually direct yourself more wisely. You're not depending on unknown circumstances from the past that have programmed you to like this when it's a sunny day but hate it when it's cloudy. Do you know how chancy half of our likes and dislikes are? And we actually think, I am choosing this? I mean, we're asleep. We're automaton.
Got it.
We're like little robots, you know, programmed and marching. It's a precious life. It's like such an opportunity to be here. Even if you're in total pain and you got a gut ache, and besides that, the milk went sour in your coffee. It doesn't matter. There is still this quality. Well, gee, sour milk and coffee. I wonder if I could possibly like that.
Mm-hmm. Gotta work on this.
And to actually take life as an adventure. You can't do that if you're wanting certain things to measure up to some ideal that is going to make you happy. Because when the certain things don't measure up an ideal that make you happy, you're going to feel either there's something wrong with you or there's something wrong with them. Aren't you? So it's always this struggle, always this war, always this difficulty. You get happy for a little while, as long as you can keep the endorphins streaming through your body. But the first day, you know, that the adrenaline starts, over the cliff of despair you go. Who's in charge? Whose life is it? So in the Buddhist tradition, especially in the Tibetan tradition, they have this thing which they call arising yoga. Sometimes it's called deity yoga. What you do is you image an ideal mind state by creating a figure that represents that image. And you make this earnest appeal, I'd like to be just like that. I'd like to have a mind state that is capable of being compassionate regardless of what arises. And you imagine you become that. Isn't that brilliant? It's like you are imagining that you are capable of changing your mind.
Yeah.
You imagine that you have the right to change your mind consciously rather than waiting for circumstances to change it and you don't have anything to say about it. You're actually choosing to come into the story and practice, choosing to like instead of disliking, choosing to dislike instead of like, and perform the actions that create the possibilities for the chemistry in your body to flow a different way so that you actually become compassionate. This is still not religion. This is still how we think of religion. This is still practicing on learning what is mind. Who is the perceiver? Is there a solid fixed self here, or is it all just chemical flows? You do something one way, endorphins are released, and it's like an opiate, and you go, oh, I like you. You do something another way, adrenaline is released, it's like, oh, I don't know, I don't trust your eyebrows. But are they you? I mean, it's just chemicals that are released. You don't know whether it happened because your mother had it happen to her when she was in your grandmother's womb, and your grandmother had this experience when she was in her mother's womb, where her mother went, ah, one day, and just happened that the energy just went that way, and this genetic code changed here, and then it was passed on to you, and you don't know whether you're disliking something because your great-great-grandmother did. or was shocked, and you know, when she picked up a bottle of water or something, you don't know, do you? And you don't even know whether it's you that really likes or dislikes, do you? So at what point do you have the right to wonder? Or are we just always caught in just always following the projections and then learning by the result? By always thinking, oh, I'm sure there's a way to go through that brick wall, and then smashing again it one more time, and then saying, oh, it's because I was bad. Well, maybe if I do 50,000 atonings, so you do 50, then you try going through it and you get smashed again. Do you understand what I'm saying? That if we keep trying to make the world give us pleasure, we're running into a brick wall over and over and over again. Sometime or other, we may actually go through a few gateways, because the brick wall might be a few doorways away. We might have the good fortune to get through one or two, which is actually bad fortune, because then we actually believe it. But sometime or other, if we keep playing to the material world, trying to make it satisfy us, we're going to die. We're going to get sick. We're going to grow old and live in a nursing home. The day is coming closer for me. Can you imagine me in a nursing home? Can you see? Can you see how quickly the staff will be trying to sedate me? So they could park me so the mouth would shut. My God. So at which point do you actually believe the truth, which is that if your happiness depends on the other, it is not safe? And do you start saying, well, what is happiness? Who is it that is looking for happiness? Who is seeing? Why is it that that looks good to me and that looks bad? You actually start being interested. In the tantric tradition and in the Buddhist tradition, this is considered to be a change in the way one is acting. In the Buddhist tradition, it's first cease to do evil. That is to say, treat the outer world with kindness. Why? Because it's harder to be clear about what you're doing if you expect the outer world to be lying because you're lying, to be cheating because you're cheating. If you're robbing everybody, pretty soon everybody is buying better and better locks. So you're living in this paranoid neighborhood. Is that true? So nobody will talk to anybody. So it makes life a lot harder, doesn't it? If you practice morality, if you decide to act on kindness, you have a sense of kindness toward everybody around you, don't you? So it's easier then to start examining who is it that is acting. If you continuously focus on having unwholesome states, it's impossible for you to go in and watch who he likes and who dislikes. Because you're so caught up in the outer and your relationship with them and whether you're going to be caught, or right? So when you cease to do evil, you start to actually practice kindness with the outer world. You practice kindness, you are doing as much as you are able, but you're not expecting the outer world to satisfy you. Then the next step, learn to do good. That's where you actually begin to practice trying to see who is it that is acting. That's when you change from the object of devotion. I really am a Buddhist and I believe in being a Buddhist, so therefore I'm taking the five precepts, and if I ever break them, I know I'm going to go to hell for lifetimes. And you're not doing that anymore. You're saying right now is hell because my motive is less than wholesome. You want to see who is acting. You want to watch the inner flow of energy. You want to watch when your heart opens to something, how does that change the way you see? How does that change the feeling in your body? how does that change the way the person in front of you feels? If you're sitting in a room and everybody's panicking, can you start to feel kindness and can you feel the calm spread through the room? Now these are the things that are interesting, aren't they? And you can't do those things if you're not at ease with the outer. So the first step is necessary before you can do the second. First step is called morality. There you go. Once you have morality, then you quit trying to manipulate the world and you want to see who is manipulating. If you want to understand what you're looking at, you have to understand how the eyes work. You know that a dog sees quite differently than you do. Do you know that? Mm-hmm. Do you know that an eagle sees quite differently than you? Do you know that? Do you know that?
Yes.
Eagle has amazingly sharper vision than you, doesn't it? Can see movement. Way, way up there. Could you see the movement of a mouse as high as an eagle?
No.
Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
They see it. Dog has a totally different nose than you. Ever gone for a walk with a dog?
Mm-hmm.
You're just walking along. Come on, come on. Oh my God, it's so good over here.
Oh,
who was that? It's a totally different world to them.
Mm-hmm.
Sense of touch and all of that. All of these are a type of consciousness. From a Buddhist point of view. And that consciousness is feeding information into the brain. And the brain is doing this little sort of word search. Oh yeah, that's me taking the dog for a walk. Oh yeah, that's the doorbell. Oh yeah, that's another Buddhist class, God, I'm tired. Oh yeah, that's, you know, whatever. So it's a perception that information is fed to the brain and the brain does a little word search and bases it on the past experiences you've had and comes up with a composite picture. Oh, that's a book. Why? Because you know what a book is. If you don't know what a book is, sometimes you don't even see it. Did you know that? Somebody can point at something, until you've seen it, you can't see it.
Mm-hmm.
Because your mind doesn't have an image for you to be able to pick it out and make it real. It's not real in your experience, therefore it doesn't exist. Now, don't you think that's interesting?
Mm-hmm.
How much of the world is not real in your experiences, so therefore it doesn't exist? If something is real in your experience and you keep looking for a way to repeat it, if you keep repeating the patterns of your childhood, is anything new going to happen? You're going to keep finding the same things you already know, aren't you? How do you bring yourself to the point to experience something that you don't know you know? Who are you? Is there actually a meaning? What is the value of existence? Like, really? Just so that we can overpopulate the planet? I think, you know, we're doing a good job of that. I mean, don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
I think we should get a B+. But is it about the human species surviving? Is that the importance? Is there a state that transcends the limited view of the conditioned mind? Well, first of all, if I'm going to go there, maybe I better find out, well, what does the conditioned mind do? Do you see why we would do that? If you want to know what is unconditioned, don't you have to check out to know what is conditioned first? Cast that aside. Huh? If you're looking for something, do you only look for it? Or do you look through all of the not it's until you find it? Huh? First you have to examine what is here. What is the motive? What is consciousness? Why do I want that? What is wanting? How does wanting arise? You have to come to the point that they say in Zen, what is your face before you were born? Isn't that nice? Before you know something, what is the knowing? Is there a knowing or being? You have to really want to know that. You have to really be interested. Other than the personal movie reel that I am shooting about life, is there anything else? Do you all know anybody who has died? Any of your relatives ever died? Any of you in this room not know a relative that died? Every one of you knows that death exists then. What happened when that person died? Or those people? Do you just say, it doesn't matter, they're dead? Do you just say, am I alive? That would be a good question. What is life? Never mind what is death, what is life? Do you have any questions, answers, comments, or complaints about what I was going to talk about tonight? Yes?
What keeps coming to my mind with what you've talking about is like I've recently become aware that I'm addicted to adrenaline.
Mm-hmm.
I think some people are addicted to downers and some are to uppers,
mm-hmm.
and I'm an upper.
Mm-hmm.
And I, being aware of that, I'm starting to realize in my, like today at work at one point, I can't remember the circumstance, but I was really aware of the fact that I was in a circumstance where I was quite calm and it was unsettling because I really realized that, like, I was thinking about doing something, and what I was thinking about doing was like a video game or something, and I went, you really want to hit adrenaline right now. And I thought, isn't that interesting? Because I can't go there anymore, right? But once you realize that, because I'm fairly addicted anyway, and once you realize that, you go, okay, now that you know that, you can't go back. So what are you going to do?
Yeah.
But it was really interesting that I'm my own drug dealer.
It is really interesting, isn't it? Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And to actually recognize that, I think, is very, very important.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, we're just out there. Aren't we?
Yeah.
You're just like creating the circumstances.
You're vibrating, but you don't know why.
Oh, you know, you do. You know, because it's they have to fix that, or they've done that wrong, or now we have to get rid of. You know, I mean, you've got, your script is written too. But this is like when you actually start to watch who's running the show at various times, the script starts to disappear, doesn't it? And there's a more of a spaciousness. Thank you. It's really lovely to hear.
The reason I had that pointed out to me was because Pat pointed it out to me because she saw it. And, you know, so it helps to have somebody.
Oh, yeah.
A partner is very important.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Both for loving and hating. In every possible way. And he says, What are you here for? Look deeper into your life's purpose. Are you here to gain a good reputation, collect possessions, trying to be beautiful? I'm not exaggerating. Check for yourself. I'm here for adrenaline. I was here to bliss out. My perfect, complete, ongoing, and difficult to achieve goal. I don't want to be here. I want to be blissed out. O-U-T. Through thorough examination, you can realize that if your entire life is dedicated to seeking happiness through things, there is no significance in being born human. Pretty straightforward, harsh statement, isn't it? If it's all about the outer, what is the significance of being human? Birds and dogs have the same kind of attitude toward life. If you think you're intelligent, you should dedicate your life to goals higher than those of chickens. You see what I mean about Lama Yeshe. I'm not deciding your life for you, but you check up. It's much better to have an integrated life than to live in mental disorder. Otherwise, your life is not worthwhile, not beneficial to yourself or others. Ask yourself what you are living for. For chocolate? For steak? Education? But that also all comes from the mind. Without the mind, what is education? What is philosophy? A philosophy is somebody's way of thinking, thoughts put together in a certain way. Without the mind, there's no philosophy, no doctrine, no university subjects. All these things are mind-made. Our reality is mind-made. How to check the mind? Just watch how your mind perceives or interprets any object that it contacts. What is feeling? Comfortable or comfortable? What feeling is arising? Is it comfortable? Is it uncomfortable? Check. When I perceive this kind of view, this feeling arises, that emotion comes. I discriminate in this way. Why? Why do I like this? Why do I dislike this? Do you understand? This is how to check the mind. And then he says, that's all. It's very simple. All you got to do is remember. When you've checked your own mind properly, you stop blaming others. You recognize actions come from your own defiled, deluded mind. When you're preoccupied with material, external objects, you always blame them and others for your problems, right? Then you become miserable because you project that view onto external phenomena instead of seeing their reality. So you can realize your false concept view, the attitude or nature of your own mind. You can see that. When you can turn around and see that, you no longer fall for it. You're less unhappy. You might think this is all very new, but it's not. Whatever you are doing, whatever you are going to do, first you always do check whether to do it or not. Don't you? Whenever you're going to do something, if you're going to come to the class tonight, first you check, well, do I really want to? Then there was some reason for you to decide to come, right? But we always do make a decision. There always is that moment. It's always there. That gap. It's always there. Since you do this already, this is not anything new. The difference is that you're not like doing it enough. You're not valuing that gap enough to look to see who's making the decision. What is it based on? You have to do more checking. To do this, you don't have to sit in some corner on your own. You can be checking your mind all the time, even while talking or working with other people. You shouldn't think that examining the mind is only for those who are on an Eastern trip. Don't think that way. You should realize that the nature of the mind is different from that of the mesh and bone of this physical body. And here it is. The mind is like a mirror, reflecting everything without discrimination. If you have understanding wisdom, you will control the sort of reflections you allow in your mind, the mirror of your mind. You notice that certain ways of the mind reflecting causes pain. And so you start saying no. He says, if you totally ignore what is happening in your mind, it will reflect all kinds of garbage.
Mm-hmm.
Things that make you psychologically ill. Your checking wisdom should distinguish between reflections that are beneficial and those that bring psychological problems. This is a little like the class last night.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, when you realize the nature of subject and object, all your problems dissolve. Right there on page 3. That's all it took. All your problems dissolve in 3 pages. Bottom of page 1. Eventually, when you realize the nature of subject and object, all your problems will dissolve. Right there. There it is, folks. All wrapped up. Now you got it. That was easy, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Some people think they are religious, but what is religious? If you're not examining your own nature, not gaining knowledge, wisdom, in what way are you religious? Just the idea that you are religious, I am Buddhist, I am Jewish, does not help at all. It does not help you, it does not help others. If you have knowledge, wisdom, you really can help others. The greatest problems of humanity are psychological, not material. From birth to death, people are continuously under the control of their mental sufferings. Some people never keep watch on their minds when things are going well, but when something goes wrong, an accident or some terrible experience, they immediately say, God, help me! They call themselves religious, but they're just joking. In happiness or sorrow, a serious practitioner maintains constant awareness of God and their own nature. You're not being realistic or even remotely religious if you forget yourself when you're having a good time, surrounded by chocolate and preoccupied by worldly sense pleasures, and turn to God only when something awful happens. That doesn't help. No matter which of the many world religions we consider, their interpretation of God or Buddha or whatever is simply words in mind, only these two. Therefore, words don't matter so much. What you have to realize is that everything good and bad, all kinds of philosophies and doctrines come from the mind, good and bad, good and bad. The mind is very powerful. Therefore, it requires strong direction. A powerful jet plane needs a good pilot. Your mind pilot should be wisdom, understanding the nature of mind. Powerful energy can be directed to benefit your life then, instead of being allowed to run uncontrollably like a mad elephant, destroying yourself and others. So the next step of Buddhism, after you learn how to see that whatever it is the inner motive, will bring up certain reflections. If anger is present, you'll be able to collect all the evidence for anger, right? If joy is present, you'll be able to collect all the evidence for joy. When you realize that the mind actually, the mirror mind can actually reflect anything, then the third step is to move beyond trying to do good or trying to do bad, but be interested in how to maintain a state regardless of whether there is wholesomeness or unwholesomeness, to move it with devotion toward the understanding of a transcendent state. That's the third step. The first step is practice goodness with the outer. The second step is become aware of the motives, the energies, the likes and dislikes, and try to see what they actually are. The third step is realize that they are essentially empty and the pictures they bring up are the empty mind, and so how to use that, whatever is present. When anger comes, to realize anger is the power of reflection, right? Because when you're angry, you separate, don't you? And you see really clearly. And how you want to be able to take that energy and use it not for hatred, but for a clarity of purpose, to clearly see the state that is transcendent of all dissatisfactoriness. Right? The third step is called purify the mind, means move beyond good or evil, or right or wrong, or subject-object. but everything is the offering. Every moment of my life is the offering to come to the end of suffering for the benefit of all beings. Every moment. There is not one place or one moment or one experience that is more important than any other. And that's a practice. That's a practice of seeing every moment as intrinsically valuable. This is the moment where the great lover is about to appear. Ah, this is the moment where I am going to meet my beloved. Ah, this is the moment. Ah, this is it. Ah, this is it. I'm ready. I'm open. Ah, my girl. Ah, how wonderful. I'm so glad you're here. Do you understand what I'm saying here? Do you think that might change the way one met the world? So that's basically what I wanted to say. I made it a little short, and usually I draw it out better, don't I? Tell more bad jokes, I usually do. Do you have any questions, answers, comments, or yeah?
Is there such a thing then? Is there any possibility for a constant solid self to exist?
Yeah.
Because we're always...
Because self arises from cause, doesn't it? Doesn't it? Where did your self come from? Well, you can say that, then again, if there's more than one, how can there be? Which one are we talking about?
Well, I guess, for lack of a better word, I would say the authentic self, but...
So this is what I was pausing. I wasn't sure what you meant by self, so maybe you could give me a better sense of that.
Well, I was listening to you, and at one time you said, for the solid self to emerge or to arise, if I remember that correctly.
Did I say solid?
Yes, I thought you said solid self.
God, I'm surprising myself.
I think in the context in which you used it, it didn't mean solid self forever or immovable or anything like that. I think it had to do with being discretionary in the beginning and not just feeding into the material cause and effect or a desire thing. And that when you get past that stage, then I thought you said a solid self sort of emerged.
Mm.
But having gotten to that point, it's not something that's like a rock. I see it more as an authentic self that's not just given to hunger and thirst and sex and sleep.
No, when you actually start questioning who is acting here, what you get to is see the process of how the likes and dislikes begin to arise. When you actually look at what is anger, you know, you just hold the mind in a neutral place and you watch when you're angry, you just watch the different energy, how that arises, and you question and you start looking for it. What will happen is that there'll be a whole streaming of different moments of anger, and then it all just dissolves. It's all just gone. And there is just this quality of just clarity, of seeing that there is a state of being, which I suppose we could call a self, that is just clarity. And all the ideas about anger or about joy or about like and dislike are based on past experiences. So if I did say that, I'm talking more about what he talks about, the mirror wisdom.
Yes, I see it more.
That but that mirror wisdom is vast. It's not limited. It's not bound. And to me, the idea of self seems to have a boundary. And when you asked the question, I thought you were saying something bounded.
Well, yes, that was my question.
And no, there is no boundary. Have you ever been able to fill your mind? You've had lots of experiences in your life, haven't you?
Yes.
Is your mind full?
No, it isn't
no.
full.
Do you think even if you lived for a few million years, your mind would fill? Do you think you could ever fill your mind?
No, I don't think you could fill your mind because I think it's...
Does your mind actually start when you start putting a lot of memories in? Do they sort of overlap each other and they start getting murky because there's like, you know, sometimes you paint a wall several times and there's bad wallpaper on it and... You know, and it, one shows through the other like that. Does that happen with your mind?
Well, the good thing I find with my
mind is she's not answering me. Is she answering me?
No.
She's just going off on what she wanted to say before I was so rude as to interrupt her, isn't she? Okay, I'll listen.
No, you
yes?
About the 10 years ago, and I was thinking about that, and I thought, isn't it great? Some of these objects are still there, but they don't affect me the same way.
No, they don't. The images are there, but they only come up when a similar mind state is present. Is that true?
Yes.
I like using anger because we're usually more aware when we're angry. When we're happy, we tend to get a little bit sleepy and blissed out. We don't notice detail. Have you noticed that? But when you're angry, you get like etchings into that seer. So you know that when you're angry and you're waiting for someone to just tell them just exactly why they are a wart on the asshole of God, and you're just waiting for them to come in the door so you can point it out very succinctly and purely. And as you're waiting, you can watch your mind going over past experiences, right? Which you haven't remembered 20 minutes before when you were happy. But now they're all coming up. Aren't they? Have you ever done that? Collected evidence?
Always.
And it's amazing how far back we can go in our evidence collection, isn't it? I like the little half ones that I connect that don't really fit in there, but I can stuff them in anyway. Sort of like footnotes to prove the point, you know, that kind of thing. They're some of my favorites. I think they're very creative. But you understand what I'm saying? So it isn't that there can't be a library of resource pictures ready to come and print with the story, with the main story, but then there's a whole library of like photographs to add to the, you know, to give it real emotional value, right? Am I making sense, or why are you thinking? Why are you thinking right now? What is it you're thinking about?
I was still thinking about, to some extent, the concept of self. Not in the sense of...
So I was really boring you, is
no,
what you're trying
no,
to tell
me. No, you weren't.
I was pretending to listen to you, but I was actually thinking about the concept of self.
No, and I was listening to you.
I was listening to you, too. Yeah,
yes.
I've heard that before.
and I was listening to you and asking myself if...
You're repeating that just so I'll really believe it. I don't... Yes, what?
I was listening to the part about the books and the library and things like that.
Yeah.
Seeing whether it tied into what it was that I was looking for.
Okay.
So I was listening.
I think when one is looking, very often one is within the walls of the looker.
Mm. You see, I find that if I have to hold on to a sense of self, that it's a form of clinging.
I don't think you have to hold on to the sense of self. I think it's hard for you to let go of it. What did I say?
You don't think that you have to hold on to the sense of self.
I said, I don't think you have to hold on. I said, and then what did I say? So that's interesting, isn't it? That's as much as you heard, isn't it? I don't think you have to hold on to a sense of self, my dear friend. I think for you it's hard to let go of one. I think it's hard for you to see the walls of the looker. Because I think your sense of integrity holds you within a particular view. But that's just my view. And I don't know who I am anyway, so. Well, thank you. I think it would be curious to try to see the walls of the looker. Like, turn around. Might be fun. But don't get too serious about it. Any other questions, answers, comments? Yeah?
When you were talking about how we see, I had this digital camera, and I realized that I was thinking about how you can zoom in on, like I can bring you really, really close, or if I zoom it out and I want to see farther, I have to kind of zoom out. And I realized that when I visualize in my mind, I have to do the same thing. If I want to see, if I'm imagining something in the middle, I have to, like, in my mind, zoom in to see the detail. And if I want to see what's beside it, I have to go back and see everything.
Mm-hmm.
So is my mind shaped by my body and the way my body sees?
They're interdependent in their shaping. The mind shapes the body, shapes the mind, shapes the body, shapes the mind, shapes the body. One cannot really say, you know, in the Tibetan tradition, for example, they talk about the container and the contained, but it's always got a slash between the two. And in the Southern school tradition, they talk about nama rupa, name, mind, body. It's always got a hyphen between the two. And it's more like, if you're going to look at that, it's easier probably to look at a river and the riverbed and the river. And we overall tend to think that the river is a static thing, but if you've ever lived by a river, you know that isn't true. That the riverbed is changing all the time, and as the river changes, so does the riverbed changes, so does the flow of the river, and as the flow of the river changes, so does the riverbed.
My body is like the bank, and my mind is like the river.
Yeah. But it is the two of them together that we call the river.
If I was blind, if I'd never seen, how would my mind be different?
Isn't that a lovely question? Don't you think that's a lovely question?
Yeah.
So why don't you really hold that? I met this man named Michael, you know, when I was living on the streets in my drug days in Vancouver. And I met him because there was this blind man walking down the street with a cane and dark glasses. And he came, and he was tapping, and he found the curb, and there was a street light, and I realized he couldn't see a street light, so like every once in a while I was actually not so stoned that I could actually be aware of other people, so I decided to help him across the street. So I helped him, I was talking to him, he was really interesting, you know? And we walked across the street, and he was so interesting, I said, well, where are you going? Because, like, you know, I had a great career of going to the next corner. I was going to panhandle that, so it didn't really matter to me, you know. And so he was going to the library, which I thought was quite neat, but I figured they had Braille books or something. I wanted him to the library. I get the library. You know what? I take him up to where he's going. You know what? He's not blind. he is just really interested in how being blind would affect your consciousness. So he had been living for 2.5 months with his eyes totally taped shut. So I got to be quite good friends with Michael whenever I hitchhiked to Vancouver. I used to spend a lot of time with him. And at another time, he was really interested in drawing a map of Vancouver from underground, because he was interested in all the wiring, the electrical wiring, and the sewer lines, and all of the different, how the city would look from underneath. So he spent hours and hours at City Hall. And I remember one time he lent me a book to read. It was really an interesting book. I gave it back to him. I said, "Michael, thanks. This is a really interesting book." He said, "Have you finished reading it?" I said, "Yes." He said, "How did you read it?" I was like, "What do you mean? You know, I started at the beginning, I ended at the end. What's your problem?" You know? He said, no. And he picked up the book and he said, "Here." And he starts and he reads the last word of every page out loud. And then he reads only the verbs. And then he reads only the... My God, I never knew there was so many ways to read English. I don't think we value questions. I think I was so lucky to meet Michael. His whole life was involved in question. He was always exploring what is consciousness, what is reality. Isn't that interesting? You know, after I met Michael, Vancouver never felt the same to me. It's a very good question. And how interested are you in moving out of your comfort zone to really pursue that question? Are you willing to go spend some time with blind people and read stories to them? They always like people to read stories. And ask them, how do you perceive? How do you perceive coffee? Could you tell me? Are you willing to, you know, really invest yourself in that question? You know, because it's a good question, isn't it? And then how do I perceive? Why do I think I know what white is? You know, in the Tibetan tradition, and in in initiations, they have this little red-hot bikini here, this little gorgiosa with hardly no clothes and lots of jewelry dancing around with her boobs banging, standing at your eyeballs with this little stick with these 5 ribbons on it. And the ribbons wave out, and the ribbons wave in, and then there's another couple here at your ear balls, and then some at your nose balls, and at your tongue ball, and then at your skin ball. There's all these different, these little bikinis doing these little waving things. Because that's how the senses work. The senses go out and come in. There's this kind of consciousness that, like, you know, moves out and moves in. In the Theravada tradition, the same thing is only as said the way the Theravadins say, that your senses are doors. Each of your senses are doors. And you know, doors go two ways. Not only do you look out, but also light comes in, or energy goes out and energy comes in. And it's really interesting when you're sitting around or waiting for a light to change or something, not too much with your eyes, more with your ears is better because you might drive into somebody, is to like look at things by watching the light coming into your eyes and feeling the light coming into the surface of your eyes and shifting that focus and watching how the whole energy in your whole body changes. So if you look differently, does that change your mind? If you hear differently, start there. Start by seeing. If I use my senses so that I'm more aware, not of, because mostly we go out with our senses, don't we? What's that sound? Mm-hmm. I'm looking at you. But if I am aware of the light rays coming from off your body, coming into my brain, that might be quite a different change of consciousness. So I really like your question, and again, I'm not going to answer it, but I'm saying explore it. Because I don't want to rob you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Doors, 2-8. Sense doors. We have six senses, the five senses and the mind that takes it all together and then makes up images so that we think we know something. Yes.
You were talking about Michael. It really became clear to me that he wasn't interested in answers, he was interested in the journey.
It was very profound to him, the journey,
yeah,
and
like
I was so
verb,
fortunate to meet him when I did.
With no noun at the end of it.
Yeah. You should have seen his maps. Underground maps of Vancouver. They were so beautiful. They were huge. He had this roll of newsprint, you know, that was just like this. We should all meet a Michael sometime or other. We should all be a Michael sometime. You know, when we're children, we do it, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
You know? You take the living, you know, the kitchen table chair and you turn it upside down and you put a coat over it. And it's not a chair anymore, is it? It's a cave.
You're your cave. And there's wild lions around.
Yeah.
And it's all possible.
It's still there. The minute you trip going downstairs, that same mind is still there. Everything's possible. Only we don't like it. Imagine practicing that with liking it. That mind of just suspending judgment for a moment with liking it. I think they call that orgasm, don't they? Well, that's what happens then, isn't it? Everything stops for a moment. There's no subject-object relating, and there's just this vulnerable openness, isn't it? I know it's been a long time, but that's what I remember. Well, you don't have orgasms. Oh, sorry. Have I offended you, I hope? Oh yeah, some of you have been married for a while. Oh, I am nasty today. Shame on me. Damn. I like your questions, great questions. Any more? Complaints? Comments? Answers? Questions? Mm-hmm.
This word self, does it really exist? I mean, you're changing from second to second. How can you, is it just a snapshot of time?
In fact, that's a very good description. A snapshot in time. Picture out, picture out, picture out. You remember when the Fab Four were here and they were talking and Rob was talking?
Mm-hmm.
About how when you see a movie and sometimes you can a car or a chuck wagon going and it looks like the wheel is turning backward, right? Have you ever all seen that?
Yeah.
Why does it look like the wheel's turning backward? Huh? You've seen it though. Did you wonder about it? Yeah, the man behind you.
I've actually heard an explanation why.
Why?
Because the number of frames in the film and the rotation of the wheel synchronized, so.
Don't synchronize.
Or don't synchronize.
Yeah. So when the wheel is turning this way, the first picture, one spoke is, oh, I can't use my crooked finger. I have to use my straight finger. First spoke is here, right? And so the first picture of the wheel is there, and then the wheel turns. But the next picture, that same spoke is only here. And the next spoke, the picture, the spoke is there. So when you're taking, when you're showing the pictures, it's a whole series that run together. But the frames look like the spokes, or the spokes are tokens, so it looks like the stills, it looks like the spokes are moving backward, even though it's turning this way if you had a constant picture, right? Does that make sense?
The same thing happens in life, though, with
and
planets
that's,
and everything.
But that's what happens with our eyes now. We actually see shot, shot, shot. That's exactly how we see. And most of the time, we're not here. That's what they say in Buddhism. And that what we do is, depending on the meaning, depending on our emotional take, we put the story together and collect the shots we like. We do our own editing. That's why, for example, my sister's father was born in Germany and my father was born in Poland. Same man. Same name. And one of these days I'll get over getting pleasure out of saying, yes, my father was born in Poland, in front of her, just so I can watch her go, he was not, he was born in Germany. But I don't know if I will or not, because I'm like just such an evil kind of person. There's something about that I really love. It just proves the truth of perception. Because actually, her father was born in Germany, and my father was born in Poland. And there's no problem with that. Because relative truth is relative, dependent on circumstances. Is there an absolute truth? That's the question. So we take our story of self's pictures as being absolute. But when do we question it? When you actually see that the self is like that. And that you have experiences of that when you're in shock or something, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
You've been in accidents where you got picture. Some of you have.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very clear, isn't it? Like that's really, and there's almost no reaction. That's why you get picture, because it's your story is woven together by the emotion you're playing into a seamless whole. Does that make sense? So they say passion and perception are linked together. Passion meaning whatever it is you're feeling. The meaning creates the storyline, and the images are edited to fit the meaning. The meaning changes, the story changes. Story changes, the meaning changes. Passion and perception are linked together. So the self can have several different memories of the same experience. Can't. Isn't that true? You know that exercise I've given you where you're sitting there and you imagine your father on your right. You know that one? Remember that one? Do you remember that, Terry? So let's just do it really quickly. So you pretend you're all sitting here. Good. Try a little harder. Your mind is wandering. Good. And pretend your father is sitting on your right, just slightly behind you, but just there. Oh, there's your mother on your left. If your father was going to imagine himself on your right, how would that change the picture of him? If your mother was going to imagine herself on your left, how would that change the picture of her? If there's some smell that you relate to your father from childhood, think of that smell and see how that would change the picture of him. So a smell that you relate to your mother and your child, how would that change the picture of her? If you do that exercise a few times, you end up with three pictures of your father and three pictures of your mother. And if you keep doing that exercise, you get lots and lots of pictures. And as you get lots and lots of pictures, this richness of the sense of your parents starts growing, and you get less fixed on the few images or the stories that are your main hopes or your main fears or your grouches or, you know what I'm saying? You start to see a more full energy of what it is you inherited. So, like, there are many selves all the time, but depending on our story, which one we pick. So to actually watch the motives is very important. Because we are creating our universe based on them. It's so magical the way we make reality. And the option that we could, like, as my beloved teacher Namgyal Rinpoche said, imagine you're awakened. That's worth trying. Any last questions, answers, comments, or complaints? Is that satisfactory for the moment? Tomorrow night it's your turn. Thursday it's my turn. I am so hungry. I am really, on Thursday I start 6 month retreat. I am so happy. And you are so supportive. And I'm so grateful.
And I am so hungry.
And I have been so busy. And this is so wonderful. And when I come out, you can test and see whether it was worth it. Did she learn anything? Oh, she now same bad jokes. Send her away again. I should try that. Get a year out of you guys.
Go back and study some more.
I'm not ready yet. So you notice this extremely beautiful gold light in your hearts, which is down there about where dinner is, but just in front of the spine. It spreads through your body, up your trunk, down your buttocks, down through your legs, to your feet, down your arms, through your hands, up your neck, through your head, out your ear bones. This beautiful gold light, just like a giggle, it spreads out from your skin. Fills this room. Fills the house, block, goes into the earth and up into the sky. All of Edmonton, Alberta, North America, the oceans, the world. This energy, this beautiful gold energy. Wherever there is suffering due to ignorance of body, speech, or mind, this energy just washes it. And think whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is no suffering. So I do. So thank you for your great compassion. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you.